November 12th, 1945, Bennington County, Vermont. While on a hunting trip on Glastonbury Mountain, 74-year-old Minnie Rivers splits off from his son-in-law, but he is never heard from again, and an extensive search effort fails to find him. Over the next 5 years, four other individuals, 18-year-old Paula Jean Weldon, 68-year-old James Tedford, 8-year-old Paul Jepson, and 53-year-old Fita Langer, all vanish within the same general area, and most of them are never found. This leads to speculation that the cases might be connected, and there is something supernatural involved, so the area becomes known as the Bennington Triangle. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our final Halloween-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold. I am your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be discussing no less than five cases which took place in an area known as the Bennington Triangle. Ever since the inception of this podcast, it's been a tradition for us to count down to Halloween by spending the month of October covering mysteries which either took place on Halloween or had some sort of spooky or paranormal slant to them. In fact, I've been following the same pattern I used when I counted down to Halloween last year, where I explore some mysteries which are alleged to have supernatural connections, though this has often been the result of misinformation and sensationalistic details being spread. I'm sure you're all familiar with the legend of the Bermuda Triangle, but the Bennington Triangle refers to an area of Bennington County in southwestern Vermont, where no less than five people went missing under strange circumstances between 1945 and 1950. A Vermont-based author and folklorist named Joseph A. Citro originally coined the phrase Bennington Triangle, and it is supposedly centered on Glastonbury Mountain, which represents the tip of this so-called triangle, while the towns of Bennington and Woodford represent the horizontal base. On this episode, I'll be covering a total of five cases involving victims named Minnie Rivers, Paula Jean Weldon, James Tedford, Paul Jepson, and Fita Langer, but even though they all supposedly took place within the same general area, I should mention that there's some differences between them. Four of these people went missing in or near a remote wilderness area and were the subject of massive search efforts, but James Tedford disappeared while in the midst of a bus trip back to Bennington. And while the first four victims I named have never been found, Fita Langer's body was discovered 7 months after she originally vanished, but her story has still been lumped in with these other cases. Of course, as the years have gone on, the legend surrounding the Bennington Triangle has continued to grow, leading to speculation that the area might be cursed, or that something supernatural might have been behind all these disappearances. But unfortunately, this has also meant that certain details about these stories have either been greatly embellished or conveniently withheld in order to add to the aura of mystery surrounding this legend. So on this episode, I'll be exploring each of these individual cases in chronological order, and we'll attempt to determine which of them are truly baffling mysteries, and which might be nothing more than tragic stories of people who got lost in the wilderness and died of exposure. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the saga of the Bennington Triangle. We'll be right back. Our story begins in Bennington County, Vermont in 1945, and our first victim is 74-year-old Minnie Rivers, who lives in the town of Bennington. Known for being an experienced woodsman and fisherman, Minnie decided to head to Glastonbury Mountain on a hunting trip with four other people, including his son-in-law, Joe Lauzon. At around 7:30 a.m. on the morning of November the 12th, Minnie and Joe left their campsite to go hunting until they arrived at a fork in the trail. The two men split up and went their separate ways, with Minnie heading in the direction of Bickford Hollow Road. He told Joe that he would return to the campsite to join the rest of the group by lunchtime, but even though Joe eventually returned to the camp as planned, Minnie did not. By 3 p.m., the group became concerned enough to perform a search for Minnie, which included yelling out his name and firing off their rifles in hopes that he could hear them. When Minnie could not be found by nightfall, the group notified the authorities about his disappearance and an extensive search was launched. A witness named Hollis Armstrong would claim that he saw Minnie over the ridge between Glastonbury Mountain and nearby Bald Mountain at around 4 p.m. on the afternoon he went missing. The two men briefly spoke, but Armstrong claimed that Minnie did not appear to be distressed, as he stated that he had no fear of getting lost. However, Armstrong also said that he last saw Minnie heading in the opposite direction away from his campsite. After Minnie went missing, one family who lived on Bickford Hollow Road reported hearing the sound of two gunshots every morning at around 6 a.m. for several days. This led to speculation that Minnie may have become lost or injured and used his hunting rifle to fire off these shots in order to signal searchers about his position. In total, the original search effort lasted 8 days, but the only evidence they found was a single rifle cartridge in a mountain stream. It seemed to match the same type of rifle that Minnie had been carrying, so it was theorized that he may have leaned over the stream to drink some water until the cartridge fell out of his pocket. In May of 1946, a hiker found a blue handkerchief in the Bickford Hollow area which had 30 cents wrapped in it. Minnie was employed at Benmont Papers and handled distinctive ink which was used in presses that printed Christmas wrapping paper. Since traces of this ink were found in the handkerchief, it was believed to belong to Minnie. Unfortunately, no further trace of Minnie could be found, but by the end of the year, another disappearance would take place in the same area of Bennington County. Our second victim is 18-year-old Paula Jean Weldon, who was originally born in the village of Bronxville, New York. Paula hailed from a prominent family, as her father, William Archibald Weldon, who went by the name Archie, was a successful industrial designer. When Paula was only 7 months old, Archie and his wife, Jean Weldon, took her and moved to Stamford, Connecticut, and they would go on to have three more daughters and make Stamford their permanent home. By 1946, Paula was a sophomore at Bennington College and had aspirations of becoming an artist when she started there, but she had since become disillusioned with the subject and seemed to have developed a greater interest in botany. Paula lived on campus at the Dewey House Dormitory alongside her roommate, Elizabeth Johnson, and the two women had an interest in the outdoors and often liked to go out on hikes together. Paula was hoping to go hiking on the 273-mile long trail, which ran from the Vermont-Massachusetts border all the way to the Quebec border and passed through Bennington County. In fact, two other female students had invited Paula and Elizabeth for a hike on the long trail on Thanksgiving Day, but the plans fell through when the other students decided to go home for the holiday instead. Paula had a job at the Bennington College dining hall, and on the morning of Sunday, December the 1st, she worked a double shift there before leaving at 1:30 p.m. Earlier that day, Elizabeth had invited Paula to take a walk with her, but Paula would not commit to anything. When Elizabeth returned to their dorm room at 2:45, she discovered that Paula was not there, and as the day wore on, Paula would not return. Elizabeth was initially not that concerned, as she figured that Paula was just spending the evening at the library to study for exams. But when Elizabeth went to bed and woke up the following morning, Paula had still not returned. When Paula did not show up for her shift at the dining hall or any of her classes that day, Elizabeth notified the college administrators, who performed a full search of the campus without success. The college president then called the Weldon family in Stamford to see if Paula had returned home, but she hadn't, so her father Archie traveled to Bennington to look for her. The Bennington County State's Attorney and the Sheriff's Department were soon notified about Paula's disappearance, and a missing persons investigation was launched. Beddington College would close for several days so that students and faculty could participate in the search effort, which involved the National Guard, firefighters, a couple of Boy Scout troops, and hundreds of volunteers. Archie Weldon also offered a reward for his daughter's return, $2,000 if she was found dead, and $5,000 if she was found alive. Investigators did explore the possibility that Paula disappeared voluntarily or went off to elope with a secret boyfriend, even though she was not believed to be dating anyone at that time. According to Elizabeth, Paula did not like to talk much about her family and gave off the impression that she was not getting along with them. But Paula had invited Elizabeth to visit her family in Stamford on multiple occasions, and Elizabeth told police that she felt Paula was the one who acted coldly towards her parents rather than the other way around. In the weeks prior to her disappearance, Paula seemed to be sullen and depressed and may have been worried about how her father would feel about her disillusionment over pursuing a career as an artist. However, on the night before she went missing, Elizabeth described Paula as being restless and full of life and energy. But when Paula left her dorm room, she left most of her personal possessions behind, including an uncashed paycheck, and was believed to have no more than $10 on her at the time. Once Paula's disappearance started generating publicity, a number of witnesses came forward who recalled seeing her on the afternoon of December the 1st, and she was described as wearing a red parka with a fur liner, sneakers, and jeans. She was seen at the end of the campus driveway at Beddington College, and a contractor named Lewis Knapp reported picking her up hitchhiking on State Route 67A. Knapp said that Paula wanted a ride to the Long Trail, but since he lived on Woodward Road near State Route 9, Knapp agreed to drive her as far as there. When Knapp dropped Paula off, she was still about 2.5 miles away from the Long Trail, but she presumably hitched another ride to take her the rest of the way. Ironically enough, it was Ernest Whitman, a night watchman for the local newspaper, the Beddington Banner, who was able to confirm that Paula made it to the trail after recognizing her photo in one of their articles. Whitman claimed that at around 4 p.m., both he and a friend of his encountered Paula as they were leaving the trail, as she asked them if it was the Long Trail and wanted to know how far it went. The last witnesses to confirm having seen Paula were an elderly couple who had been walking about 100 yards behind her on the Long Trail and saw her turn a corner near the Faye Fuller camp at about 4:15 before they lost sight of her. All the witnesses who saw Paula accurately described the red parka she had been wearing, and even though her clothes were appropriate for the mild weather at that time, it would not have been adequate for when nightfall hit and the temperatures dropped to barely above freezing and it started snowing. At one point during the search effort, Archie Weldon left Beddington County without telling anyone where he was going, as he simply left a message with his wife in Stamford in which he stated, quote, "I am following a hunch of my own, and I may be gone for several days." Archie did not resurface for 36 hours, and his unexplained absence briefly caused him to be looked at as a potential suspect. Well, it turned out that a waitress at a restaurant in Fall River, Massachusetts, had reported seeing an agitated, dazed-looking woman matching Paula's description, who was in the company of a young man who appeared to be intoxicated and abusive. According to the waitress, while the man was paying the check, the woman called her over and kept asking for directions to Beddington. Once Archie learned about this lead, he decided to travel to Fall River in order to check it out for himself, but from what I can tell, the sighting of this woman turned out to be a likely case of mistaken identity. 2 weeks after his daughter went missing, Archie packed up all of Paula's belongings in her dorm room and took them back to Stamford. Archie publicly criticized the search effort for Paula, as he felt it was very disorganized and did not believe the Beddington County authorities handled it well. He even went so far as to contact the governors of Vermont and Connecticut, who agreed to allow the Connecticut State Police to assist with the investigation. At the time, the state of Vermont did not have their own police agency, as all of their law enforcement was county-based. But this case played a huge role in convincing the Vermont General Assembly to create the Vermont State Police, which officially went into operation in July of 1947. From that point on, the Vermont State Police would take responsibility for search and rescue operations in the wilderness. One individual who appeared to be a promising suspect was a lumberjack named Fred Gaudette. Everyone who lived on the Long Trail was questioned by the authorities, including a woman named Viola Maxwell, who reported having seen a woman in a red parka matching Paula's description walking north on the trail towards the woods on December the 1st. Fred Gaudette was Maxwell's on-again, off-again boyfriend, and sometimes lived with her and her children. He initially told investigators that he was in New York State on the day Paula went missing, but some of Maxwell's children claimed that Gaudette had been at the residence that day. Gaudette was questioned several more times, but kept changing his story and giving inconsistent accounts of what happened. The story Gaudette finally settled on is that he did show up and park his truck at the Maxwell residence that day and saw Viola talking with two men in a car. Gaudette suspected that Maxwell might have been cheating on him with one of these men, so they soon got into an argument inside his truck. While this was going on, Gaudette said that he saw Paula walk past them up the trail, and the two men in the car would verify that they had also seen a young woman in a red parka walking through the area at this time. Afterward, Gaudette claimed that he left in an angry rage and spent the night in a shack located across the road. In 1952, law enforcement received a tip that at least two witnesses had heard Gaudette tell them that he knew where Paula Jean Weldon was buried. When police questioned Gaudette about this, he claimed that he had only been joking about knowing the location of Paula's remains because he wanted to increase his local prestige. However, Gaudette once again changed his story about his whereabouts on the day Paula went missing. Even though he had originally said that he spent the night in a shack after leaving Viola Maxwell's residence, he now claimed that he left in his truck and drove down the Long Trail in Paula's direction. In spite of investigators' suspicions about Gaudette, there was no direct evidence to link him to Paula's disappearance. In 1951, Paula's case would attain additional notoriety when Shirley Jackson, author of such famous horror novels as The Haunting of Hill House, published a book titled Hangs a Man. The fictional plot was loosely based on Paula's disappearance, as it chronicled a lonely female student who devolved into madness while attending a liberal arts college. At the time Paula went missing, Jackson was living in North Bennington, and her husband was employed at Bennington College, so she became very familiar with the case, and it always haunted her. Unfortunately, the investigation into Paula's disappearance reached a standstill, and in October of 1970, Archie Weldon passed away at the age of 70, without receiving any answers about what happened to his daughter. But Paula's story would eventually be linked to some other odd disappearances from the area. On December the 1st, 1949, exactly 3 years to the day when Paula went missing, a 60-year-old man named James Tedford also went missing under very strange circumstances. James was a World War I veteran living in a soldier's home in Bennington, and even though he was married, his wife Pearl was living separately from him in the town of Franklin, located 165 miles north. On November the 27th, James traveled there to visit Pearl and her relatives, and began his trip back to Bennington 4 days later. James's brother-in-law accompanied him to a bus station in the town of St. Albans and saw him board a bus at around 1:30 p.m. Later that afternoon, James made a stopover at a bus station in Burlington, 30 miles away, and bumped into a friend of his named Walter Lamb. The two men briefly chatted before they went their separate ways, and James was scheduled to board his bus before it traveled another 120 miles down U.S. Route 7 to Bennington. Now, if you research this case online, you're going to read a lot of accounts about James vanishing without explanation from the bus, and they contain a lot of strange details which may not actually be true. I'll be addressing that later on in this episode, but for now, I'll only be sharing verified information which has actually been published in original newspaper articles. We do know that James went missing at some point, but his disappearance was not noticed for 6 days when the soldier's home phoned Pearl and asked when her husband would be coming back. Obviously, since James was supposed to return to the soldier's home on the evening of December the 1st, this caused great concern and he was reported missing to the authorities. Pearl and her relatives told investigators that when they last saw James, he seemed depressed and was not looking forward to returning to the soldier's home. The staff at the home also confirmed that James's mental health was not good, and since he only weighed 116 pounds at that time, he was described as looking frail and thin. In fact, some of James's colleagues at the soldiers' home claimed that when he left to visit his wife in Franklin, he told them he would never return. There were reports that at around 8 p.m. on the night he went missing, a man matching James' description, who was also wearing similar clothing, was seen getting off a bus in the town of Brandon, located about halfway between Burlington and Bennington. There was also an account from a state policeman who recalled seeing a man matching James' description getting off a bus in Brattleboro, located 40 miles east of Bennington. However, neither of these sightings could be confirmed, and James Tedford was never found. The next Bennington Triangle disappearance took place in 1950 and involved an 8-year-old boy named Paul Jepson Jr. Paul's parents, Nancy and Paul Jepson Sr., were former high school teachers from Schenectady, New York, but now lived on a farm with Paul Jr. and his younger sister near the town of Shaftesbury, located just over 9 miles north of Bennington. While Paul Sr. worked as a tax collector, the family earned additional income by being caretakers of the town dump on East Road, where they kept around 65 pigs. Sometime between 3 and 4 p.m. on October the 12th, Nancy drove Paul to the dump in her truck so that she could feed the pigs and move them from one area to another. According to Nancy, Paul wanted to remain inside the truck, and she left him unattended for about half an hour while she performed her work. When Nancy returned to the truck, Paul was not there, and after she was unable to find him, she went to a nearby home in order to call her husband, and he subsequently contacted the police. A massive search effort was launched for Paul, but it would be hampered by rains and mudslides. A bloodhound was brought in, which followed Paul's scent at the intersection of East Road and Chapel Road before losing it. Since East Road was in fairly close proximity to U.S. Route 7, investigators explored the possibility that Paul wound up inside a vehicle which fled the area. It also seemed plausible that Paul could have wandered away from the truck on his own, as he apparently had a fascination with mountains, and Glastonbury Mountain could be seen in the distance. But unfortunately, no trace of Paul could be found, and there was no evidence to indicate what might have happened to him. But believe it or not, another disappearance would take place in Bennington County just 16 days after Paul went missing. The victim in question was 53-year-old Frieda Langer, who hailed from North Adams, Massachusetts, but both she and her husband, Max Langer, often took trips to Bennington County, as they had owned a camp there for 14 years, and liked to go camping, hiking, and hunting nearly every weekend. On the afternoon of Saturday, October the 28th, Frieda, Max, and Frieda's cousin, Herbert Elsner, were in the midst of one of their weekend trips and camping out in an area near the Somerset Reservoir. They were planning to go hunting for partridge, but since Max was suffering from rheumatism in his left leg, he elected to stay behind at the camp while Frieda and Herbert left. According to Herbert, at around 3:45 p.m., they were about a half mile away from their camp when Frieda slipped and fell into a shallow stream. She told Herbert that she needed to change into some dry clothes, so he escorted her to a bank which was about 150 yards away from the camp. They then went their separate ways so Herbert could continue hunting, but when he returned to the camp during the early evening hours, he was surprised to learn from Max that Frieda never showed up there. The two men performed a search and failed to find Frieda, so they subsequently reported her missing to the authorities, who launched their own search effort. Since Frieda was a very experienced hiker, her husband was baffled by the idea that she could have gotten lost only 150 yards away from their camp. Max stated, quote, "She knows this country like a book because she's trampled all over every weekend for the last 10 years, end quote. The search for Frieda lasted 2 weeks and involved aircraft and helicopters, but it failed to turn up any trace of her. But unlike the other cases I've discussed, this one did eventually end with the victim being found. On May the 12th, 1951, 6.5 months after Frieda originally went missing, a pair of fishermen discovered her decomposed body on the east branch of the Deerfield River near the flood dam. This location was just over 3 miles away from Frieda's camp, and even though it had been previously searched months earlier, it was theorized that Frieda may have fallen into a deep, water-filled hole covered with grass underbrush. Her body then remained concealed for months until the water level rose during the spring and caused it to float free and become lodged on the riverbank. Now, you're going to find some sources out there, which state that they could not determine Frieda's exact cause of death, and I'll rant more about this later, but this is not true at all. According to contemporary news accounts, there were no signs of foul play at all, and the authorities concluded that her cause of death was accidental drowning. 5 years earlier, Frieda had undergone an operation for a brain tumor and experienced occasional blackouts and seizures following the surgery. Even though her husband maintained that Frieda did not have any problems for at least 18 months prior to her disappearance, it's been theorized that she may have experienced another medical issue which caused her to become disoriented before she wandered off and drowned. Officially, Frieda Langer's case is considered to be closed, so I would question whether it should still be classified as an unsolved mystery. All that being said, Mitty Rivers, Paula Jean Weldon, James Tedford, and Paul Jepson are still missing persons, and the mysterious aura of the Bennington Triangle lives on. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So I'm sure you've heard me mention all month that one of the primary focuses of my Halloween-themed episodes has been to cover unsolved disappearances and murders which supposedly have some sort of supernatural slant, which may be the result of misinformation and embellished details. This logic would definitely apply to the Bennington Triangle, or any mystery in general with the word triangle in it. I hate to say this, but the mystery of the Bermuda Triangle was pretty much ruined for me at a very young age, because my father was a commercial airline pilot, and he told me that he had personally flown through the Bermuda Triangle numerous times without incident. A few years ago, I also did a podcast episode about the Vanishing Triangle, a section of Ireland where no less than 8 women went missing over the course of 1 5-year period. Of course, this caused speculation that these cases might be connected, and all these women were victims of some serial killer. But if you explore each of the disappearances individually, it becomes apparent that a number of these women were likely murdered by someone from their personal lives, and that at most, maybe 2 or 3 of the cases might be connected. It seems like people do have a fascination with mysteries that occur within geographic regions shaped like triangles, and since we had 5 disappearances take place within Bennington County within 1 5-year period, you can understand why they all wound up being lumped together. There have always been urban legends that the Bennington Triangle is cursed and that the Native Americans of yesteryear always made a point to avoid it, but while a cluster of disappearances like that is unusual, ask yourself how many more people have gone through that same area without incident. I think it's safe to say that all 5 victims did not fall prey to some serial killer, because you couldn't find a more diverse selection of victims. 2 elderly men, 1 middle-aged woman, 1 18-year-old female university student, and 1 8-year-old boy. Looking back at the original media coverage of these cases, it seems like the whole aura of mystery really came into play in October of 1950, when Paul Jepson and Frieda Langer went missing within 16 days of each other, and the newspapers started linking them to the previous disappearances of Mitty Rivers and Paula Jean Weldon. But since all these people went missing in the wilderness, I really have no idea how James Tedford's case wound up getting lumped in with them, since he supposedly vanished from a bus, and we can't even be certain if he was in Bennington County when this happened. Regardless, it seems like all 5 of these cases would end up being discussed in conjunction with each other, though the phrase Bennington Triangle did not enter the equation until Joseph A. Sitrell came up with it in 1992. But let's look at each of these cases individually and determine how mysterious they really are. For starters, I don't think Frieda Langer's case should even be considered a mystery anymore, since she was found. Even though many modern retellings of this story make it sound like no one had any idea how she died, all you have to do is go back into the newspaper archives to determine this is not the case. It seems pretty clear that Frieda was the tragic victim of an accidental drowning, And while we'll likely never know the full circumstances of how this happened, the authorities were pretty certain that no foul play took place, and they wound up closing the case. It would be one thing if Frida's loved ones continued to dispute that her death was an accident, but her husband Max and her cousin Herbert Elsner accepted the ruling without hesitation. Most modern accounts state that the area where Frida's body was found was searched multiple times, but if she fell into a deep hole and did not surface until the water level rose in the spring, then that would explain why the searchers missed her. And of course, many sources fail to mention the surgery Frida went through to remove a brain tumor and her subsequent medical issues, which could explain why she became disoriented and got lost, even though she was only 150 yards away from her camp when she was last seen. Now, admittedly, during the early stages of the investigation, there was some suspicion directed towards Herbert Elsner, the last known person to see Frida alive. We technically only have his word that Frida fell into a stream and he escorted her to a bank so close to her camp. On November the 3rd, 1951, 1 week after Frida originally went missing, a closed inquest was held at the municipal courtroom in Brattleboro, and Herbert and Max were scheduled to appear at 2:30 p.m. But earlier that morning, Herbert and a search party went out to Somerset Reservoir to look for Frida, but he wound up splitting off from the group and getting lost. Herbert was found later that afternoon near the flood dam, in close proximity to the spot where Frida was eventually found, so you could interpret this as Herbert attempting to avoid appearing at the inquest, or perhaps taking the opportunity to move Frida's body to where it was found. However, when questioned, Herbert did pass a lie detector test, and I see no indication that he or Max were ever considered to be suspects. The autopsy turned up nothing on Frida's body to indicate that she was the victim of a homicide, so if the authorities had any inkling that Herbert killed her, I'm sure they wouldn't have been so quick to close the case and rule it to be an accidental drowning. So yes, if Frida's death had not occurred within the Bennington Triangle, around the same time period these other disappearances took place, I'm not sure her story would even be remembered today. However, the other four disappearances are technically still unsolved cold cases involving missing persons who were never found, so they are worthy of further discussion, even though foul play may not have occurred in any of them. There is a decent chance that Mittie Rivers, Paula Jean Weldon, and Paul Jepson all suffered the same fate as Frida Langer by wandering off and succumbing to the elements, though obviously, the circumstances of how James Tedford went missing are much different. The one thing all these cases have in common is that the victims vanished between the months of October and December when the weather was not the best, so it would have been really easy for them to dive exposure and the search efforts to miss finding their bodies. I'm going to save my analysis of Paula Jean Weldon's disappearance until the end, as it's definitely the case that got the most attention, but I have a feeling that Mittie Rivers' disappearance might be the least mysterious. At 74 years of age, Mittie was the oldest of these victims, but even though he was an experienced outdoorsman who was considered to be in good condition for his age, he easily could have been stricken with a sudden medical episode that caused him to become disoriented and get lost. All we know is that Mittie split off from his son-in-law to go hunting and did not return to his campsite like he planned, and the only evidence that was ever found was the rifle cartridge in the stream and the handkerchief containing 30 cents, which may have belonged to Mittie. We also have the account from the local residents, who claimed that they heard two rifle shots being fired every morning at 6 a.m. in the days following Mittie's disappearance. If Mittie was lost or injured, he may have done this in hopes that the search parties would hear the shots and find him, but he also didn't fire off more than two shots at a time because he wanted to conserve ammunition. Perhaps the oddest detail is the eyewitness sighting from Hollis Armstrong, who claimed he saw Mittie in the area at around 4 p.m. on the day he went missing. The reason this sighting is so strange is because Mittie had told his son-in-law he would meet their hunting group back at their camp for lunch, but this would have been several hours after the fact. It does not sound like Armstrong noticed anything unusual about Mittie or got the impression he might be lost. So either Mittie lost track of time or was too stubborn to admit that he couldn't find his way back to the camp, or to become confused and disoriented, and Armstrong just did not realize it. The most logical explanation is that Mittie died of exposure and the search effort simply missed his remains, but an alternate theory which was pushed forward is that Mitty may have accidentally been shot by another hunter, who subsequently disposed of his body in order to cover up what they did. I think the main reason this theory took shape is because of another unsolved cold case that took place in Bennington County 48 years earlier. In October of 1897, John Harbour, a 40-year-old deer hunter from Woodford, was found shot to death in the Bickford Hollow area. Since the murder was never solved, and no one could figure out a possible motive, it was speculated that Harbour was the victim of an accidental shooting from another hunter. Without Mitty's body or any other hard evidence, we really don't have any idea what might have happened to him, but it would not surprise me at all if he simply succumbed to the elements. Now, the disappearance of Paul Jepson is a particularly tragic story since he was only 8 years old, but even though there isn't any real evidence to work with, it's possible that he also wandered off and died of exposure. However, given Paul's young age, we can't rule out the possibility that he was abducted by a stranger. Even though Paul went missing in a remote area, he was technically last seen alive inside a parked truck, as his mother Nancy said that she left him unattended for about half an hour in order to deal with some pigs at the town dump. When you look at this case from today's perspective, I'm sure it's easy for alarm bells to go off about Nancy Jepson. Indeed, there was gossip throughout the community that Paul's parents might have been responsible for his disappearance, including one particularly nasty rumor that they fed his remains to the pigs. Paul Jepson Sr. did hire an attorney and made a statement that the family would not speak to the police or the press without legal counsel present. But it's worth mentioning that the authorities questioned the Jepsons pretty extensively and always publicly confirmed that it was strictly routine. They never gave off any impression that Paul's family were involved in his disappearance or knew more than they were letting on, so while leaving an 8-year-old boy unattended in a parked truck for a half hour might seem unusual today, it was just a much different time back then. It's worth noting that Paul was homeschooled by his parents, and contemporary news accounts state that Paul did not attend school because of, quote-unquote, nervous defects. I have no idea what that means, but in online discussions about this case, I've seen speculation that Paul might have been on the autism spectrum, a disorder no one would have even been aware of back in 1950. It was reported at the time that Paul did have a few prior incidents of running away, though he would always be recovered safely within a short amount of time. Some modern sources state that Paul often spoke about the, quote-unquote, lure of the mountains, though I think that detail may have been embellished a bit, since lure of the mountains does not strike me as a phrase that an 8-year-old would use. But it does seem like a confirmed fact that Paul did have a major fascination with mountains, and Glastonbury Mountain could be seen in the distance from the spot where the Jepson's truck was parked. If Paul did have an undiagnosed case of autism spectrum disorder and was very determined to visit some mountains, he very well could have left the truck and wandered off in that direction. A bloodhound was able to track Paul's scent from the truck to a nearby intersection, which could be seen as a sign that he climbed into a vehicle, but investigators also acknowledged that Paul's scent may have been lost because it rained almost immediately after he went missing. Once again, there is really no concrete evidence pointing towards what actually happened to Paul, because even though we can't discount the possibility that he was the victim of an abduction, what are the odds that a child predator would cross paths with him in such a remote area? Given that the weather was pretty miserable following Paul's disappearance, it's not hard to imagine him succumbing to the elements and the massive search effort failing to turn up his body. Unless some human remains can be found, I'm not sure we'll ever know the full truth about what happened to Paul. So now we have to talk about the disappearance of James Tedford, and to borrow a quote from the late, great pro wrestling announcer Gorilla Monsoon, this case is a fountain of misinformation. To give you an idea of what we're dealing with, it's tough to even figure out the proper spelling of the victim's last name, as some sources say it's Tedford with a T. But since contemporary news accounts spell it Tedford with a D, I have to assume that's the correct one. The issue with lumping James' case in with the other Bennington Triangle disappearances is that we can't even be certain that he went missing in Bennington County to begin with. It sounds like the last confirmed sighting of James took place in Burlington, which is located in Chittenden County, and while he supposedly boarded a bus, which was heading down U.S. Route 7 to Bennington, we can't even be 100% sure he was on it. So many accounts make it sound like James somehow vanished into thin air on a moving bus, which would be pretty puzzling, but here's where the misinformation and embellished details come in. Many modern sources state that the bus driver and the other 14 passengers all remember James, and that when they last saw him, he was sleeping in a seat. By the time they arrived in Bennington, James was gone, but his luggage was left behind in the overhead rack, and an open bus schedule was found on a seat. Well, guess what? None of these details are mentioned in any of the original news coverage of this case from 1949, and I have a feeling that they may have been added to the story over the years in order to add an extra aura of mystery to the whole affair. Now, news articles did confirm that James boarded a bus in St. Albans and arrived in Burlington for a stopover, where he bumped into a friend of his named Walter Lamb at the bus station. While some sources state that Lamb personally witnessed James board the bus to Bennington, this is not mentioned in any of the original news accounts, so for all we know, James could have boarded a bus to another location or simply wandered away from the station. Don't get me wrong, James did vanish without a trace and was never found, so the story is still a big mystery, but it seems like certain details were heavily embellished to fit the whole Bennington Triangle narrative. There are definitely a lot of unanswered questions about James's background, as he was living in a soldier's home in Bennington while his wife Pearl lived in Franklin, which was over 3 hours away. I get the impression that James wound up in the soldier's home because he couldn't take care of himself, and if he was still making lengthy trips to see Pearl, I'm guessing that their marriage had not fallen apart. But it sounds like James was not in a good place at that time, as he was 68 years old and was described as being frail and weighing only 116 pounds and suffering from mental health issues. It's been reported that James was quite despondent at the idea of leaving Franklin to go back to the soldier's home, and before he left there, he apparently told some of his colleagues that he would never return. This is why I think it's very plausible that after he made a stopover in Burlington, James never boarded the bus to Bennington, but whether this was planned or he became disoriented and wandered off is unclear. If James was truly despondent about returning to the soldier's home and never wanted to go back there, perhaps he went off to a remote area and took his own life, and his remains have never been found. Hell, he may have even wandered off into a remote area and died of exposure. Or perhaps he became a homeless transient or a John Doe somewhere, and because he did not actually go missing in Bennington County, it was much harder for the authorities to put two and two together. We have separate accounts from different eyewitnesses who believe they saw a man matching James' description getting off a bus in the towns of Brandon and Brattleboro on the same day he disappeared. Obviously, at least one of these witnesses must be mistaken, and it's possible that both of them were, but you can't rule out the idea that James climbed onto another bus. Brandon is located about halfway between Burlington and Bennington, and Brattleboro is about 40 miles east of Bennington. For all we know, perhaps James really was planning to go back to Bennington, but became confused and got on the wrong bus or got off the bus at the wrong location. Whatever happened to James, this is still a very sad and tragic story, and since it's hard to pinpoint the exact spot he disappeared from, I can understand why this case would have been so difficult to solve, particularly in 1949, when spreading the word about missing persons was a more challenging task. But I think we can safely say that James did not magically vanish from a moving bus, and since I have my doubts he went anywhere near Bennington County on the day he went missing, this could probably be classified as a completely unrelated cold case which has nothing to do with the Bennington Triangle. So now we'll close this episode off by discussing Paula Jean Weldon's disappearance, which was a pretty big deal at the time, so much so that Paula's case and the Bennington Triangle both have their own separate Wikipedia pages. On the surface, it might appear that Paula wound up suffering the same fate as most of these other missing victims, as she may have gotten lost during her hike down the Long Trail before she succumbed to the elements, and the extensive search effort failed to find her remains. After all, Paula decided to go hiking alone in an area she had never visited before, and she was not adequately dressed for the freezing temperatures which would hit once nightfall occurred. But on the other hand, unlike these other cases, there is a promising potential suspect who could have done Paula harm. The best source of information about Paula's story is the 2010 book, Clueless in New England, published by author Michael C. Dooling. In addition to Paula's case, it also covers the unexplained death of 32-year-old Catherine Hall, who vanished after walking away from her grandmother's residence in Lebanon Springs, New York, in April of 1936, before her skeletal remains were discovered in a wooded area 7 years later. The book also delves into the 1952 disappearance of 10-year-old Connie Smith, who vanished while walking away from a summer camp in Salisbury, Connecticut, and we also covered this one on episode number 109 of The Trail Went Cold. Clueless in New England was the first time I'd ever read about Fred Gaudette's possible involvement in Paula's disappearance, but I'll talk about that momentarily. One of the big unanswered questions in this case is why Paula decided to leave her dorm room and go hiking on the Long Trail without even telling anyone. Paula's roommate, Elizabeth Johnson, shared her interest in hiking and proposed the idea of going for a walk together earlier that day, but Paula would not commit to it. It's obvious that Paula really wanted to hike the Long Trail, since she had hoped to do so on Thanksgiving Day before plans fell through, but why didn't she invite Elizabeth to come along? She just seemed to make a spontaneous decision to leave on her own accord, and if multiple witnesses hadn't recalled giving Paula a ride to the trail and seeing her there, I'm not sure anyone would have figured out what happened to her. While eyewitnesses in missing persons cases can often be mistaken, their accounts all corroborated each other, particularly their descriptions of Paula's red parka, and helped establish a solid timeline of Paula's movements. It might raise a few eyebrows that Paula decided to hitchhike to the Long Trail, but hitchhiking was just a much more common practice back in 1946, and according to Elizabeth, it wasn't uncommon for both of them to use it as their primary mode of transportation whenever they wanted to go hiking somewhere. Even though there was speculation that Paula might have staged her own disappearance or ran off with someone, she left most of her personal possessions and an uncashed paycheck behind, so the evidence does suggest that Paula was planning to return to her dorm room that evening. I guess one alternate possibility that we can't completely write off is that Paula may have been feeling suicidal and decided to travel to some remote location in order to take her own life. According to Elizabeth, there were many signs that Paula was feeling depressed in the weeks prior to her disappearance, and it sounds like she did not feel her relationship with her family was in a good place. Paula believed that her father was going to be disappointed about the fact that she lost her passion for pursuing art as a career, but it's tough to know if these fears were founded. Elizabeth did accompany Paula to visit the Weldon family in Stamford on multiple occasions, and always felt that her parents came across as warm and welcoming, whereas Paula seemed to be acting coldly towards them. On the weekend before Thanksgiving, Elizabeth went back home to visit her own family and said that Paula was very depressed when she returned, as she had just experienced a sad, lonely weekend by herself. This is when a decision was made that Paula needed to expand her social circle beyond Elizabeth, and she did go on to meet a new group of friends, including a young man who took her to a square dance on Thanksgiving evening, though they never actually became boyfriend and girlfriend. But given how sad Paula had been when Elizabeth left her alone for the weekend, this once again begs the question of why she decided to go hiking on the Long Trail by herself. Well, on the night before she went missing, Paula was described as being a lot more restless, energetic, and full of life than usual. Much like the speculation about Paul Jepsen's undiagnosed autism, it has been theorized that Paula may have been suffering from undiagnosed bipolar disorder, as no one would have even known what that was back in 1946. The world was just not as educated about mental illness back then, but this could explain Paula's sudden mood changes and her inexplicable decision to hitchhike to a remote trail to go hiking, even though she was not adequately prepared for the situation. Given the circumstances, it's not hard to imagine Paula becoming lost and succumbing to the freezing temperatures once nightfall hit. Remember, the original search effort faced criticism for being disorganized, so they could have easily missed her remains. However, we must hearken back to Fred Gaudette, who garnered suspicion from the authorities by constantly changing his stories about his whereabouts and his movements on the day Paula went missing. It seems like one aspect of Gaudette's account, which is truthful, is that he was having a heated argument with his girlfriend, Viola Maxwell, inside his truck when Paula walked past them. Two other independent eyewitnesses were able to corroborate this, as they recalled seeing a young woman in a red parka walking through the area while this argument took place. But we still don't have a concrete story about Gaudette's whereabouts after this took place. In his original story, he claimed that he went to a shack across the road and spent the entire evening there, but when re-interviewed years later, he changed his story and said that he drove off in his truck and headed in the same direction where Paula was walking. This in itself might not be reason enough to suspect Gaudette, but the reason he was re-interviewed in the first place is because two other witnesses claimed that Gaudette had told them he knew the location where Paula's body was buried. Gaudette never even denied that he said this, and claimed that he only made up the story for attention, but you can understand why this would be considered to be a red flag. By his own admission, Gaudette was in an angry mood following his argument with Viola Maxwell, since he believed she was cheating on him. If Gaudette really did drive off in Paula's direction and cross paths with her, he may have decided to take out his aggression on this random young woman who was walking through a remote area on her own, and that's how she wound up dead. I don't find this scenario to be implausible, but investigators never found any evidence linking Gaudette to Paula's disappearance, and while details about Gaudette's background are limited, I haven't read anything about him having a criminal record or a history of violence. To determine Gaudette's potential involvement, it would help to know the exact timeline of all the eyewitness sightings of Paula on the Long Trail that day. We know that she conversed with Ernie Whitman before she started walking on the trail, and some sources say that the last confirmed sighting of Paula was from an elderly couple who saw her turning a corner on the trail near the Faye Fuller camp at around 4:15 p.m. If these sightings took place after Paula walked past Gaudette's truck, then I think this decreases the likelihood of him being involved in her disappearance, since it would have been difficult for Gaudette to continue following her without being seen by these other witnesses. But the book, Clueless in New England, makes it sound like Gaudette, Maxwell, and the other two men at the scene were the last people to have seen Paula walking on the Long Trail. If this is true, then it's possible that Gaudette may have caught up with Paula and harmed her before disposing of her body. But like so many of these other Bennington Triangle cases, it's difficult to reach a definitive conclusion since there's just so little evidence to work with. So I could go either way with Paula being the victim of foul play or death by misadventure. So that pretty much brings an end to my analysis of the Bennington Triangle, and I think it's safe to say that I do not believe anything supernatural took place in these stories, or that the area is cursed. In at least two of the cases, James Tedford and Frieda Langer, I think that certain details were embellished or key facts conveniently left out in order to add an aura of mystery to this whole saga. As far as I'm concerned, Frieda Langer's death is a closed case and no longer an unsolved mystery. And while the ultimate fate of James Tedford is still a mystery, it's possible that he did not even go missing within the Bennington Triangle to begin with. But ironically enough, even though James probably did not vanish from a moving bus, I probably still consider his disappearance to be the most mysterious of these cases. Since Mittie Rivers, Paula Jean Weldon, and Paul Jepson all went missing in remote wilderness areas, it's possible that they simply wandered off and died of exposure. But we still don't have any idea what actually happened to James Tedford, so the possibilities in his case are endless. Much like the Bermuda Triangle, I believe that the legend of the Bennington Triangle was enhanced by the fact that some people just happened to vanish without a trace within that particular area. However, you also have to ignore the fact that considerably more people have spent decades going through the area and survived unscathed, and it was just an anomaly that five different people went missing there during a five-year period. The silver lining to all this is that the legend of the Bennington Triangle has ensured that even though more than 70 years have passed, all five of these victims continue to be remembered to this day when they might otherwise have been forgotten. And remember, four of these victims are still missing and deserve to be found, so if by chance you happen to have information about any of the unsolved cold cases from the Bennington Triangle, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about an odd case from Unsolved Mysteries, the story of Dan Tundevold, a mysterious con artist who swindled a wealthy socialite out of her fortune before he supposedly killed himself in what may have been an attempt to fake his own death. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1991 murder of Soo-Ya Kim. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Catherine K., Ginger S., and Jackie P. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for the upcoming premiere of the sixth season of the podcast, True Crime Bullshit.
All right, it is 5 a.m. on Friday, October 7th. I am on my way to the airport to fly out to Washington State for a week-long sonar and ROV search at Lake Crescent with Gene and Sandy Ralston. It's been 9 years since I started looking into the enigmatic and meticulous serial killer Israel Keyes. And in those 9 years, I've read over 10,000 pages of documentation, listened to over 40 hours of interviews, interviewed forensic experts, former FBI agents, potential witnesses, and people who knew Keyes. I've traveled tens of thousands of miles to almost everywhere Keyes had ever been. And now, going into its sixth season, True Crime Bullshit has more new leads and more new information than ever. And we are getting closer and closer to understanding and exposing the crimes of Israel Keyes. True Crime Bullshit returns for its sixth season on October 27th. Subscribe and listen anywhere you get your podcasts. And check out truecrimebullshit.com for timelines, videos, and more.
I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. And you might have noticed that we brought back the spookier version of his Trail Went Cold theme this month for our Halloween episodes. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, we hope you enjoyed this month's Halloween-themed episodes, and I'm pleased to announce that sometime within the next week, I'll be participating in a collaborative project titled A Nightmare Before Halloween. The whole thing was organized by Shane Waters of the Foul Play Podcast, as this will be a massive cross-promotional episode featuring several true crime podcasts in which we each record our own segment about a Halloween-themed case. Each of these podcasts will drop the finished episode into their own individual feed, so you can expect to see it pop up in the Trail Went Cold's feed sometime within the next few days in time for Halloween. So until then, have yourself a good week, and join us next Wednesday as we resume running our regular new episodes of The Trail Went Cold. Oh.